Good evening, everybody, coast to coast. This is Douglas Edwards.
Tonight, Armstrong Circle Theater goes after a most unusual story, The Riddle of the Flying Saucers. We will depart from our usual format, and instead of dramatizing an adventure, we ask you to participate in a controversy. Are UFO, unidentified flying objects, real or imagined? Now, if these so-called flying saucers are real, where do they come from? Are they secret weapons being tested by our own or foreign governments? Or are they, as many believe, spacecraft from other planets invading our atmosphere, actually observing life on Earth? Tonight, we're going after this story. We're going to the government files and to experts on all sides of the issue. We're going after facts. In just a few moments, UFO, the enigma of the skies, on the Armstrong Circle Theater. Today we stand on the threshold of outer space. Is space the emptiness we've long believed? It may not be. For life, intelligent life, may already exist somewhere out in the unmeasurable vastness of space. In a universe containing billions of planets, millions of galaxies, by the simple law of chance, there must be planets enough like our own to sustain life. Actually, some authorities have gone so far as to offer evidence that such life does exist. Here's an example of the evidence they offer. This is the planet Mars with its mysterious canali, the lines crisscrossing its surface. 40 years ago, Percival Lowell, a distinguished American astronomer, stated that the canali are evidence of intelligent life on Mars. He said Mars was a dying planet from lack of water, and the lines were actually irrigation canals that the Martians had dug to bring water from the melting polar ice caps into their parched planet. Well, let's look at another example. This is the moon, our nearest neighbor in space, and the only one our powerful telescopes can carefully survey. For years, astronomers have been mapping its surface. Some have seen strange things indeed. Here, for example, is a rough sketch that was supposed to show streets and avenues in a region of the moon known as Schroeter's Valley. In 1953, a report was made that a gigantic bridge now stretches across a region of the moon known as the Mare Crisium. Scientists charted this region many years ago, and no such bridge was in evidence then. If it's a natural object, why wasn't it seen before? If it's not a natural object, then what can it be? There are those who claim that its construction proves the existence of intelligence on the moon. Not necessarily moon people, but beings from outer space who are using the moon as a space station for their observation of Earth. How can we find out about this? Where do we start? Well, we start with background, with history. Unidentified flying objects are nothing new. The Bible gives us a report of a sighting by the prophet Ezekiel. A sign in the heavens, large, brilliantly colored, in the shape of a wheel within a wheel. 1554, a mysterious object flashed across the sky near Saint-Chamond, France. 1709, a flock of strange phenomena invaded the skies over Europe. Today, science explains most of these ancient sightings in terms of natural phenomena. Meteors, shooting stars, comets, or unusual auroral displays. But not too easily explained are some occurrences of not too long ago. November 23rd, 1896, Oakland, California. A mysterious object appeared in the sky. A strange, cigar-shaped object, reportedly witnessed by thousands, sailed eastward. Moving slowly, gathering headlines, the UFO was reported from Salt Lake City, Denver, Omaha, and finally Chicago, where it sailed off the front page into the unknown. The first few decades of the 20th century brought few sightings, possibly because the flying saucers took a dim view of this newly invented earthly airplane suddenly trespassing their private domain. But in 1947, year two of the atomic age, the real UFO story began. It began here, the Pacific Northwest, one June morning 10 years ago. In the vicinity of Mount Rainier, a C-46 Marine transport plane crashed. Among the volunteer civilians who aided the military searchers was a veteran mountain pilot who had logged thousands of hours of flying in the area. What he saw and reported made international news. Here now is Irv Kunick, a man who over the past months has literally spent hundreds of hours reading the mass of material printed on the subject, interviewing the people involved. Irv, what was seen near Mount Rainier on that memorable afternoon?
Well, to begin with, Doug, though it's popularly thought that the Mount Rainier incident represents the opening of the current phase of flying saucer history, that's not quite right. The fact is that during World War II, a number of military pilots reported rather strange round objects that mysteriously circled or paced their planes in flight. Now, Air Force intelligence investigated these reports. That's on the record. However, the incident that did trigger the current interest in UFO was the Mount Rainier occurrence. It was while the mountain pilot was searching for the crashed marine transport that he noticed a terrific blue flash reflect from his airplane. The pilot noticed that the flash came from a chain of rather peculiar-looking objects that were approaching Mount Rainier, flying a course of about 170 degrees. Now, he assumed at the time that they were a formation of some new type of jet, but it rather baffled him because they just didn't seem to have any tails. Now, he judged their wingspan to be about, 120 feet across. The pilot watched them for several minutes. They were traveling from north to south and flying in a rather reversed echelon formation. And as they flew, they weaved in and out between the mountain peaks. They had kind of a skipping motion as they sailed along, and after the sighting, the pilot landed and reported the incident to the local representative of the CAA, the Civil Aeronautics Administration. The pilot didn't make too much of the incident. He thought they were just a new type of jet. Described them as fluttering, and, he said they flew like you took a saucer and skimmed it across the water. And some newspapers printed a rather gobbled version of this, and they quoted him as saying that they looked like saucers when he said that they flew in a saucer-like fashion. And that was rather an historic misquote, because that's how the name flying saucers came to be. Now, our Air Force was investigated at the time, and they said no Air Force or naval aircraft were flying in the vicinity of Mount Rainier on that day. The possibility of foreign aircraft being present was just not believable. So the only conclusion that the pilot could come to was that they must be of extraterrestrial origin, from another world, another planet.
This Mount Rainier sighting might have been quickly forgotten, except that within the next 30 days, there were 53 more reports of so-called flying saucers. But making allowances for illusion, delusion, hoax, and hallucination, there remained enough incredible reports by credible observers to set people thinking. They came from every section of the country. San Fernando, California. Boulder, Colorado. Washington, D.C. Greenwich Point, Long Island. And if anyone was less than serious about flying saucers, the tragic Mantell incident at Godman Field, Fort Knox, Kentucky, gave them real cause to reflect. On January 7th, 1948, early in the afternoon, Kentucky State Police reported an unidentified flying object, circular in appearance, moving westward at a good clip. The UFO was also sighted by the commanding officer of Godman Field. The control tower at the field checked and found no experimental aircraft in the neighborhood. Just at this time, a flight of F-51s under the command of Captain Thomas Mantell, a veteran combat pilot, neared the field and was immediately vectored in on a strange spherical-shaped object. What happened then depends upon what version you read. There were 7 witnesses in Godman Tower, and their accounts differ in many details, but this is sure. Captain Mantell, by radio, reported sighting the object above him. He said it was a metallic thing and of tremendous size. Mantell's plane was not equipped with oxygen, and yet he headed upward. By 15,000 feet, his wingman had broken off. Mantell was in a maximum climb at 22,500, his plane under perfect control. Well, from this point on, there's nothing but mystery. Transmission was garbled, and attempts to contact Mantell went unanswered. Mantell's plane began to level off at 30,000 feet, began a gradual turn to the left, and then it nosed downward, and at full power, began to dive. Between 10 and 20,000 feet, the plane literally tore apart. Mantell was killed. Parts of his plane were found more than half a mile from the wreckage. You know, there are questions that must be answered about this tragic incident. Why did an experienced pilot like Mantell break one of the cardinal rules of flying, never go above 10,000 feet without oxygen? What did he see that forced him to throw caution to the winds? After the Mantell crash, UFO reports continued to pile in. During January and February of 1948, the sightings took on an international flavor. Balls of fire traveling slowly across the sky were reported from Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Germany, and then Southern Europe chimed in, and then South America. On July 21, a report came in from Holland of a UFO, rocket-shaped, with 2 rows of windows along the sides. This might have been forgotten fast, except for what happened just 1 week later. On July 24, 1948, a commercial airliner flying from Houston, Texas to Atlanta was 20 miles southwest of Montgomery, Alabama. At the controls, Clarence S. Childs and his co-pilot, John B. Whitted. At 2:45 in the morning, these veteran flyers saw a light dead ahead and closing in fast, traveling at a speed estimated between 500 and 700 miles an hour. The light bore in on them. The rocket-shaped object was brilliantly lighted, and it appeared to have 2 rows of windows. Underneath, from the belly of the ship, there was a sort of a blue fluorescent glow. As they watched, fascinated, the object flashed by about 700 feet to their right. On landing, Childs and Whitted reported the incident to the proper authorities, and then each drew a sketch of what he'd seen. This is the Childs sketch. Double windows, in size about twice the diameter of a B-29. And this is the sketch drawn by co-pilot Whitted. The same general shape, a double row of windows, or what appear to be windows, no wings. What was it? To this day, according to the 2 pilots involved, no logical explanation offered by scientists, by experts, fits the bill. People may argue about what they saw, but they can't deny that they saw something. Something that these men, with thousands of hours of flying experience, had never seen before and haven't seen since. Well, is there an explanation, a reasonable, natural explanation for the mysterious object seen by so many credible observers over the past 10 years? For this, or this? To get the official Air Force point of view, we're going directly to the source, directly to the Air Force files that have been thrown open to us. Can every sighting be reasonably explained, or must we accept the proposition, the fact, that at least some of these objects originate in outer space, and that our Earth is now being observed by creatures from another world? Barely a day passes, but that sightings of flying saucers are reported. People are seeing something. Something is there. An employee of a supersonic laboratory saw a thick ruddered object shaped like this. 2 airline pilots spotted a round object with portholes and flashing lights. A group of college professors in Lubbock, Texas, saw these lights moving across the sky. Authorities have been accused of dropping a paper curtain on this problem, issuing statements, hiding the true facts from the public. But what are the facts? Where's the evidence? Where do we go for our story? Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, location of the Air Technical Intelligence Center, Air Force collecting point for all UFO sighting reports. The outfit charged with the responsibility of analyzing all flying saucer data. Project Blue Book. Since January 1953, the investigation work of Project Blue Book has had the services of the 42nd 02nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron, Air Defense Command. That's a highly trained field investigation outfit with field units scattered around the country, so deployed that they can arrive on the spot almost immediately after a sighting is reported to them. Over 6,000 reported flying saucer sightings since 1947. Each sighting investigated and analyzed by specialists and top-notch military and non-military scientific personnel at Wright-Patterson. We get the full promise of full cooperation from the Air Force, and to explain how the Air Force reaches certain conclusions on certain sightings, the Air Force has detailed to us Lieutenant Colonel Spencer Wheaton, Chief of the Air Intelligence Office, Air Technical Intelligence Center. He will explain. These files, many of which were hitherto classified, but now thrown open to us. This, for instance, is the complete file on the Mantell case, the tragic incident we talked about earlier. Originally, it was reported that Mantell might have mistaken the planet Venus for a UFO, flown too high, blacked out, and crashed. Colonel, I understand the Air Force no longer holds to that opinion.
No, we don't, Mr. Edwards. We still believe that he blacked out from lack of oxygen and crashed. And this is supported by findings of the Air Force accident investigators, an outfit completely independent of Project Blue Book. But we are now sure that this is what he was chasing. A skyhook balloon, a giant 100-foot balloon used to gather information about the upper air, cosmic radiation, wind flow, temperature. In 1948, these were top secret. Few knew about them. Later, investigation revealed that in January 1948, that is the time of the Mantell crash, these skyhook balloons were being launched from Clinton County Air Force Base in southern Ohio. We examined a weather map showing wind direction on 7 January 1948. Starting here at Clinton County Air Force Base, prevailing winds would have carried the balloon west for a while as it climbed. At about 35,000 feet, the balloon would have entered the wind jet stream, flowing south. It would have moved rapidly south, still climbing. At a point south to southwest of Air Force Base here, it would have climbed up out of the jet stream into a calm belt. And from there, it would have drifted very slowly south and southeast, directly over the area where the UFO was spotted.
Now, Colonel, you believe it's possible for trained observers, pilots like Captain Mantell, to see a balloon and not recognize it as such?
Certainly, Mr. Edwards. In a period when balloons of that size were rare, a balloon can be sent into an almost horizontal position by strong wind currents. During the day, a balloon can look like this. But visibility can play tricks. And the same balloon at twilight or dawn can look like this. Angle of vision is important. Now, this sighting, reported over Minneapolis, photographed with the gun camera of an F-86 fighter, also turned out to be a balloon. And here's another. A balloon launched in Japan was tracked by government facilities all the way across the Pacific. It meandered all over the country before it finally sailed off into the Atlantic. This resulted in literally dozens of UFO reports.
On that basis, then, Colonel Wheaton, some large percentage of flying saucer reports are actually nothing but balloons, right?
Oh, right, Mr. Edwards. They can show that balloons account for 26.4% of all recent UFO sightings.
Well, let's take another case. Three objects observed, round-shaped, steady white light, no trail or exhaust, moving slowly southwest of Macon, Georgia. Weather clear and visibility unlimited. Photographs made and available. No interception or identification action taken. No air traffic in general area at time of sighting. What about this case, Colonel?
Well, the first thing we did was to get a map. Now, here's West Macon, Georgia. And here's Fort Benning. We immediately established that training operations were being conducted at Benning. Part of the operation was the dropping of parachute flares from aircraft, as well as jet support for ground operations. We obtained the photographs mentioned in the report. Using a new photoanalysis technique, we managed to get some surprising results. Well, the first slide showed little more than two brilliant dots with some indefinite green shading around them. But on further enlargement, the wings and body of jets come into view. The bright object is the flame from the jet's afterburner. Oh, conventional aircraft often seem to be what they are not. This is the plane flying at high speed in a fog-shrouded sky. Speed causes a moisture condensation around the wings, which gives the appearance of a disc or saucer. Planes of unorthodox configuration, like swept wing or delta jobs, or this radar plane, called the flying pancake, give rise to many UFO sightings. Based on our latest reports, the cases where aircraft have been reported as UFOs account for 28.8%.
Another case now. Spring, 1957. A commercial airliner flying between New York and Puerto Rico had an extraordinary experience. Flying at 19,000 feet, it sighted a large, bright object that appeared to be coming directly towards the liner. It was described as a magnesium flash in color with a pale green tint. The pilot had to swerve his plane violently to avoid collision. What does the Air Force have to say about it, Colonel?
Well, a check of military positions in the area ruled out any unusual plane or missile activity. However, the Civil Aeronautics Board did report six other commercial flights over approximately the same area at the time of the sighting. Five of the six planes reported similar sightings. Plotting their positions on a map showed all the planes had sighted the same object. The major clues we had to work on were the color, the trajectory, and the fact that three of the planes reported that the object seemed to split apart in the air. Now, this description coincides with the known features of what are called bolides, or fireballs. Rather rare astronomical phenomena, but reported from time to time, and especially from the southwest.
And so the Air Force attributes this sighting to a fireball, right?
Oh, it wasn't only our finding, Mr. Edwards. We submitted all the data to a member of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, who confirmed our conclusions completely.
Do these astronomical phenomena play a large part in the UFO story?
Pretty large. The moon and the planets observed through haze, light fog or moving clouds. All these things can play optical tricks. And then there are the rarer celestial sights. Mirages, auroral displays. Or how about this? Caught by an Air Force photographic mission over Richmond, Indiana. And actually, a sub-sun effect. A rare aerial phenomenon caused by the reflection of the sun's rays on suspended ice particles. Strange or unusual weather tricks not only fool the eye, but such supposedly foolproof mechanical marvels as radar. Temperature inversion, where a mass of cold air collides with a layer of warm air. Or even thunderclouds sometimes come up on the radar scope as blips. One minute you see them, and the next moment you don't. Even the most experienced radar operator can be fooled by these. We attribute 24.4% of current UFO sightings to astronomical phenomena.
Well, here's another case, Colonel Whedon. The date, August 1955. The place, Kentucky. Now, according to press reports, an entire family was besieged all night by goblin-like creatures reported to have emerged from a flying saucer that landed nearby. Here is a sketch of one of these extraterrestrial visitors drawn by a local artist and sworn to as accurate by the family. One of your investigators didn't get a chance to interview him, did he, Colonel?
No, unfortunately, he didn't seem to be around, Mr. Edwards. But we did interview the family. Now, they had spent the evening attending a spirited meeting. They'd all undergone a tremendous emotional experience, which quite possibly might account for the incident.
I suppose this whole UFO situation is complicated by crackpots, publicity seekers, and hoaxers, is it not?
Oh, it definitely is, Mr. Edwards. One of the roughest areas involves the so-called contact sightings. People who claim to have spoken to creatures from flying saucers. Some who claim to have ridden in them. And one, at least, who was whooshed off to Venus and there married into Venusian royalty.
Oh, what a trip.
A whole cult has grown up around these contact incidents, and woe to him who dares to question.
Doesn't the Air Force question, Colonel?
Well, we never go on the assumption that anything is a fraud. We put all material sent to us through the analysis mill. Cleverness knows no end in this flying saucer business. He is a beauty. Oh, enlargement reveals strange lines coming from the object. And further enlargement shows these lines to be part of the corner ceiling of a room. The saucer turned out to be a light fixture. Well, here's a flying saucer. It turned out to be a flying hat. And here's a real prize. Supposedly a UFO, picked up by a science teacher.
Looks very, very formidable. A genuine Sputnik, maybe, Colonel?
Well, afraid not, Mr. Edwards. Whoever made it went through a lot of trouble trying to letter Russian words on the inside, but they got the letters wrong and forgot to remove the name of the New Jersey manufacturer from the tubes.
I see the words there and the tubes.
There's nothing but a hodgepodge of wires inside. There are no real circuits. They don't go anyplace. To finish it off, to give the effect that this thing went through space, I suppose, they used a blowtorch to scorch the sides.
Still, a rather neat job for those of us not up on our Sputniks.
Well, the important thing, Mr. Edwards, here, is that this type of hoax could be a violation of federal law. And it is a rather expensive joke. A single UFO investigation may well cost the government thousands of dollars. The perpetrators of these childish pranks might think twice about it when they remember that it's their own tax money that's being wasted. Money that could go into, should go into, the serious research so badly needed at this time.
In the total picture, Colonel, what percentage of current UFO reports does the Air Force classify as hoaxes?
Well, we lump this category into a general heading, along with sightings that turn out to be birds, searchlights, and so on. And they add up to 6.4%.
And can ATIC solve all UFO reports referred to it?
No. Many sightings come to us with insufficient data. Pertinent items of information missing. No precise description of size, shape, or color of the object. Without knowing direction and altitude, time and location, wind and weather conditions, we cannot reach a valid conclusion. The Air Force provides every observer of a UFO with a detailed questionnaire. The answer is kept in confidence if it is so desired. But we must have full information if a sighting is to get a complete analysis. Sightings that come to us with insufficient information account for 12.1% of all current UFO reports.
Colonel, let's do a little arithmetic. A little rapid calculation here. Adding these percentages, if it comes out right, let's see, it would figure out to 98.1%. Now, that's a large percentage, but it's not 100%. That still leaves 1.9% still to be explained.
Let 1.9% remainder represents the cases the Air Force classifies as unknown.
And this category is different from insufficient information, I take it.
Yes.
In what way, Colonel?
Well, take the child sighting you mentioned earlier. This case has all the elements we require for investigation. Yet after the most careful study and analysis, we cannot fit it into any of our regular categories. It doesn't appear to have been a balloon, a plane of any kind, nor does it fit the circumstances of an astronomical phenomenon. In view of this, that is sufficient data, but no logical explanation. We classify it as a true unknown. Now, this doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, we don't dodge the issue. It's an unknown, and so listed. Unknown, not because it's anything new and strange, but simply because we can't identify it with the particular normal phenomenon it undoubtedly is.
Not too high a figure. Little less than 2%. 2 out of 100. Yet, if even only 1 in 100 represented an object of interplanetary origin, we still would have to call this the biggest news of this or any century. What's the opinion of those who believe in flying saucers about that 2%? Or for that matter, what about their opinion of the Air Force Analysis Program, Project Blue Book? There's several sides to every story. You've heard only one. Unknown is defined in the dictionary as not discovered, not identified, not brought to knowledge. After 10 years of investigation and analysis, the Air Force still lists a small percentage of UFO sightings, flying saucers, as unknown. But to many who have become intensely involved in the puzzle of UFO, this figure seems utterly unrealistic. Of the scores of private, non-government organizations that are devoted to UFO, possibly the most active and eminent is the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena of Washington, D.C. On its board of governors are a number of outstanding citizens. Among them are Vice Admiral R.H. Hillenkoetter, former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, Rear Admiral H.B. Knowles, U.S. Navy retired, Major Dewey Fournay, Jr., former Air Force UFO investigator. Its director is Major Donald E. Kehoe, Annapolis graduate and a former Marine Corps pilot, author of Flying Saucers from Outer Space. Well, Major, you've seen our report on the Air Force conclusions dealing with the current UFO sightings. They've narrowed the unknowns down to 1.9%. How do you feel about that figure?
Well, even if you accept that figure, Mr. Edwards, there's one thing you have to remember. It covers only the last 2 months of sightings. Actually, the figure for all unknowns since 1947, using official Air Force statistics, is over 12%. Now, that is based on this official Air Force record, known as Project Blue Book, and tables which you will find showing various percentages over the years. Out of the 6,000 cases investigated by the Air Force, 700 still remain unknown. It comes down to this. Either all of the hundreds of skilled observers, that means pilots, missile trackers, radar operators, and astronomers, were either deluded or incompetent, or they saw exactly what they reported. I think everyone will agree that deluded pilots would have been grounded very quickly, and incompetent radar men would have been fired. Not one such case is on record. Our National Investigations Committee has hundreds of UFO reports from highly trained observers describing real objects maneuvering under intelligent control.
Real objects under intelligent control, the implication being that they originate in outer space, I suppose.
Well, actually, that is a probability which is shared by many pilots and many scientists, including, for instance, Professor Herman Oberth, the great rocket designer. So we must agree that it is a probability.
Well, all right, we'd like to hear the evidence on which you base this particular assumption, Major.
Fine. And I want to begin by saying that all the cases I intend to cite are known to the Air Force. I also want to point out that our analysts on the committee include astronomers, missile engineers, pilots, radar men, former intelligence officers, and experts in many associated fields. Now, here is a verified case. May 1954, Dallas, Texas. a flight of four Marine Corps jets commanded by Major Charles Scarborough sighted in broad daylight a formation of 16 disks flying in groups of four. When the jets tried to box in these disks, they climbed at terrific speed and disappeared. Here's a quote from Major Scarborough. "These disks were real. They flew at incredible speed." Another case. November 1957, Long Beach, California. Major Lewis F. Baker, commanding officer of the Air Force weather station at Long Beach, along with two other Air Force weather experts and 10 airmen. This group saw a formation of six disks making terrifically fast turns and maneuvering at an altitude of 7,000 feet. They appeared to be larger, according to Major Baker, than a twin-engine airliner. Statement from Major Baker. They were circular and the color of spun aluminum. They changed course instantaneously. A case in 1952. This was from Captain William B. Nash, a veteran airline pilot. He and his co-pilot sighted a formation of eight 100-foot disks flying an echelon below their plane. Captain Nash told me personally, "I am convinced these were machines from outer space." End quote. Our committee agrees with the announcement of the Air Force on this particular case, objects unknown. Let's take another commercial airliner case. This airliner was flying near South Bend, Indiana. At the controls was a veteran, Captain Robert Adickus. Adickus, his crew, and 10 passengers saw a spherical object pacing the plane. When Adickus tried to close in, the UFO accelerated and raced out of sight. A quote from Captain Adickus, "Before then, I wasn't convinced by the saucer reports. Now I know they do exist." Let me show you one more case. This is from an eminent astronomer, Dr. Clyde Tombaugh, discoverer of the planet Pluto. Dr. Tombaugh sighted a cigar-shaped object with what appeared to be windows and moving at tremendous speed. Now note how similar this object is to the one sighted by Captain Chiles and Whitted that you mentioned earlier. Dr. Tombaugh, "These things, which do appear to be directed, are unlike any other phenomena I ever observed. Other stars in our galaxy may have hundreds of thousands of inhabitable worlds. Races on these worlds may have been able to utilize the tremendous amounts of power required to bridge the space between the stars." End quote.
These cases you've cited, Major, are from the files of the National Investigating Committee. You also have some analyses on some of the cases the Air Force discussed earlier, have you?
Yes, we do, and I'd like very much to go into two of them. First, the Mantell case. Project Blue Book says that, or suggests, that Mantell died chasing a Skyhook balloon. The Air Force has never provided any record of a balloon being launched on the day Mantell crashed. There is absolutely no record that any Air Force or Navy balloon was launched then from Clinton Air Force Base or any other station. Now, any project in a top-secret category must keep detailed, accurate records. It's not any casual operation. Yet no such report has ever been produced. And now another point, which I believe is conclusive. The Air Force tells us that the balloon hovered over Godman Field for 2 hours, almost motionless. Minutes after Mantell's disappearance, one of his wingmen, equipped with oxygen, took off and searched the entire area for 100 miles. He found absolutely nothing. Now, what happened to the balloon? The searching plane was an F-51, which could fly at 350 miles per hour. Any slowly moving balloon would have been sighted in minutes, but the sky was completely empty. Now, just a word about another case the Air Force presented. This was the airliner which flew between New York and Puerto Rico and which Project Blue Book says sighted a bolide or fireball, which caused the pilot to zoom to miss it. Now, when we investigated, we found that the Civil Aeronautics Board disagreed entirely with that conclusion. The professional astronomers the CAB consulted said there was no evidence that this UFO was a fireball or a meteor. Our committee agrees that this case is an unknown, just like the tragic Mantell incident.
Well, now, Major, you believe that the massive weight of evidence proves that flying saucers are real.
The committee and I, we believe it absolutely. We believe that despite the frauds and hoaxes that have clouded the issue and which we completely disavow and try to disprove, we believe the facts prove that flying saucers actually exist.
And, of course, which puts you on exactly the opposite side of the fence from the Air Force. How do you account for that, Major?
Well, there are two possibilities, Mr. Edwards. First, an honest difference among analysts. Second, there is an official Air Force policy believed in the best interests of the people not to confirm the existence of UFOs until all answers are known. It is the belief of our committee, and this belief is substantiated by many scientists and experts in the field, that the public should be given all official information relative to UFOs. The American people are wise enough to evaluate this material, providing it is presented fully and accurately. The National Investigations Committee hopes that this will be done promptly. And now, Mr. Edwards, I would like to make a disclosure, something which has never been revealed to the public. For the last 6 months, our committee has been working with a Senate committee which is investigating official secrecy on UFOs. If the hearings are held, open hearings, I feel it will prove beyond doubt that the flying saucers are real.
In order to secure the information we need, we suggest that all of the citizens in this right.
Thank you, Major Keogh. One of the most eminent men of science who has taken a deep interest in the problem of UFO is Professor Donald H. Menzel, Professor of Astrophysics and Director of the Observatory at Harvard University and author of Flying Saucers, published by the Harvard University Press. Professor Menzel, in your considered opinion, has our atmosphere been invaded by spaceships, flying objects originating in outer space?
No, emphatically no. Now, I don't quarrel with the assumption that there is life on other planets. As I have stated on a number of occasions, life, even human or superhuman life, may exist in millions of places in the universe. And I also concede that space travel for Earthlings is imminent. But these two facts can't justify the conclusion that flying saucers represent space travel in reverse.
And yet tonight we've heard a good bit of evidence that UFO, unidentified flying objects, do exist, Professor.
They are unidentified flying objects only because of mistaken identity. In fact, they are often not even objects. That is why I prefer the name flying saucer to the term unidentified flying objects, which implies that they are material or tangible. The observations, and most particularly the interpretation of these observations, is strictly a scientific matter. You wouldn't call in a carpenter to diagnose a pain in your stomach. Well, why call in untrained laymen when you want to diagnose a strange occurrence in the sky? And strange things do occur, all the time. I think Project Blue Book hasn't paid enough attention to aerial phenomena in its analysis work. Mirages, ice crystal reflections, even cloud formations such as this one. These can and do account for many UFO reports. It's understandable that untrained observers are startled when they see unusual occurrences in the sky. It even happens to many of us who have studied the heavens for years. It happened to me. Let me give you the bare details. Just 3 years ago, when I was flying from the North Pole to Alaska, I saw an object pop over the horizon and buzz my plane twice. Then it stopped and flew along parallel to it, at an apparent distance of 300 feet. I judged it to be about 2 feet in diameter. It seemed to have flashing red and green lights and something that looked like a lighted propeller on the top.
Did you ever find out what it was?
Certainly. As soon as I got over the initial shock, I did a little calm analyzing. The mysterious saucer proved to be a mirage of the bright star Sirius. Actually, the star was slightly below the horizon. But the queer bending of light by the atmosphere, called refraction, had brought it into view. Distortion and diffusion caused by alternate layers of warm and cold air had added the finishing touches, creating a bizarre, pulsating, whirling effect similar to the twinkling of a star. That was the answer to my saucer.
and to a lot of other people's saucers, I'd like to bet. And I've seen hundreds of other saucers from dozens of causes. For instance, high-flying spider webs, owls that glow in the dark.
In other words, Professor, if more people were astronomers, there'd be fewer flying saucers.
Fewer flying saucers and a lot less beclouding of the issue by overeager amateurs. Earlier in the program, you mentioned the reported sighting of a bridge on the Mare Crisium region of the moon. Now, that's my special field. I'm now preparing some new lunar maps for a field guide to the skies that will soon be published. The first man who reported that bridge, an amateur, used only a 4-inch telescope. Now, that's like using a BB gun in an elephant hunt. I've examined that area with the Harvard 15-inch telescope, and there is no bridge there. Here's a photograph of the Mare Crisium region taken with the 12-inch telescope at Griffith Observatory. An untrained observer might possibly interpret this fan of light as coming from under a bridge. Actually, it is light shining through a well-known deep pass bordered by high peaks. No bridge exists. This only emphasizes the importance of careful observation by experienced people who are capable of evaluating what they see.
Well, let's agree that astronomers are best equipped to evaluate aerial phenomena. But wouldn't you agree that pilots, meteorologists are also trained observers, and many of them have reported UFOs?
No, they're not trained observers in this sense. A pilot can observe a plane and know what it is. A meteorologist can spot a cloud and not be fooled. But many things occur in the sky that are completely beyond the knowledge or experience of many pilots or weathermen. Mirages, mock suns, caused by the reflection from ice crystals. They're fairly uncommon. But when they do happen, only trained scientists can recognize them and understand them. If a pilot swerves his plane to avoid a fireball that misses him by hundreds of miles, or if he fails to identify a sundog, that doesn't mean he's incompetent as a flyer. I think Mantell didn't die chasing a balloon, nor I think he died chasing a spaceship. I believe he mistook some sort of aerial phenomenon, a mock sun perhaps, for a flying saucer. Went up too high and crashed.
Well, summing up then, Professor, you feel that all the flying saucers reported in the past 10.5 years, even before that, including the 1.9% the Air Force classifies as unknown, can be explained then as completely natural occurrences?
I most certainly do. And I think the Air Force has been put upon in this whole affair. They've had to make their investigation, of course. They're bound by the most serious of considerations, the security of our country. But it's gone far enough. In my opinion, it's not the reports of the flying saucers that should be analyzed. It's the non-qualified interpreters themselves who argue that these saucers come from outer space.
Thank you, Dr. Menzel. We've given the facts, we've had the opinions. What about our own conclusions? Well, for thousands of years, man has been studying his own body, and yet today, he can only explain about 25% of bodily functions. It's only 350 years since Galileo invented the telescope. Certainly, there must be much in the heavens left to be explained. Perhaps, in time, the enigma of the skies, flying saucers, will be explained to the satisfaction of all. This evening, we've given you the facts as we've found them. We leave them with you. What do you think? In just a few moments, the Honorable Richard E. Horner, Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development, will bring you a summary of the Air Force position and the report by a special scientific panel. Now, the Honorable Richard E. Horner, Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. During recent years, there has been a mistaken belief that the Air Force has been hiding from the public information concerning unidentified flying objects. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I do not qualify this statement in any way. The activities of the International Geophysical Year, which is serving to focus more trained eyes on the skies than ever before, climaxes 10 years of Air Force investigation of UFO sightings. All but a small percentage of these reports have been definitely attributed to natural phenomena that are neither mysterious nor dire. A report of a special scientific panel on UFOs assembled at the request of the United States government concludes that the evidence shows no indication that these phenomena constitute a direct physical threat to national security. They find no evidence that UFOs are capable of hostile acts. They find no evidence that UFOs indicate a need for revision of current scientific concepts. And finally, they recommend that the subject be stripped of the aura of mystery it has unfortunately acquired. The panel's findings coincide completely with the announced position of the Air Force. There is no evidence at hand that objects popularly known as flying saucers actually exist. Not a single speck of material evidence, not a fragment of a flying saucer, has ever been found. This does not mean that the Air Force can or will be complacent about UFO reports. We will continue our program of detailed investigation of all UFO sightings and invite everyone who observes an object in the sky he sincerely cannot identify or explain to report it immediately to the nearest Air Force activity. Thank you and good night.